outside. I could feel the storm in a way that a lot of people can't. And most of those who can put it down to nerves. It was raw energy up there, naked and pulsing through the clouds. I could feel water in the rain, and the clouds, moving air, blowing the droplets in gusts against the walls of the house. I could sense, waiting, the fire of the deadly lightning, leaping from cloud to cloud above, and seeking a path of least resistance to the patient, timeless earth that bore the brunt of the storm's attack. All four elements interacting, moving, energy flashing from place to place in each of its forms. There was a lot of potential in storms that a sorcerer could tap into if he was desperate or stupid enough. A lot of energy to be used up there, where the forces of ancient nature brawled and tumbled. I frowned thinking about that. It hadn't occurred to me before. Had there been a storm on Wednesday night? Yes, there had. I remember thunder waking me for a few moments in the hours before dawn. Could our killers have tapped into it to fuel his spells? Possibly. It bore looking into. Such tapped magic was often too unstable or volatile to use in such carefully directed fashion. Lightning flashed again, and I counted 3 or 4 seconds before the rumble reached me. If the killer was using storms, it would make sense that if he or she were to strike again, it would happen tonight. I shivered. My stomach growled, and more mundane matters took my attention. My head was feeling somewhat better. I wasn't dizzy anymore. My stomach was furious with me. Like a lot of tall, skinny men, I eat endlessly, but it never stays on. I have no idea why. I shambled into the kitchen and started building up the grill. "Mister," I called. "You hungry, bud? Gonna fry up some burgers." Lightning flashed again, closer this time, the thunder following right on its heels. The flash was bright enough to sear through my half-sunken windows and make me wince against it. But in the flash of light, I caught sight of Mister. The cat was up on top of my bookshelf, on the far corner of the apartment, as far as it was possible to get away from my front door. He was watching it, his eyes luminous in the half-dark. And though he had the cat-lazy look of any lounging feline, his ears were tilted forward, and his gaze focused unwaveringly upon the door. If it had a tail, it would have been twitching. There came a knocking, a rapping, at my chamber door. Maybe it was the storm making me nervous, but I quested out with my senses, feeling for any threat that might have been there. The storm made a mess of things, and all of that noise, both physical and spiritual, kept me from being able to tell anything more than that there was someone outside my door. I felt in the pocket of my duster for the gun, but I remembered that I'd set it aside in the lab last night and not taken it with me down to the police station. Police don't take kindly to anyone but police toting firearms into a station, don't ask me why. In any case, it was out of easy reach now. And then I remembered that Linda Randall was supposed to show up. I berated myself for getting spooked so easy, and then again for sleeping in so long, and then again for looking and smelling like I haven't showered for a couple of days or combed my hair or shaved or anything else that might have made me marginally less unappealing. Oh, well. I got the impression that with Linda, that sort of thing doesn't seem to matter too much. Maybe she was into Odie Holmes. I walked over to the door and opened it, smoothing back my hair with one hand and trying to keep the sheepish grin off my face. Susan Rodriguez waited outside in the rain, her black umbrella held above her. She wore a khaki trench coat and an expensive black dress beneath it with heels. Pearls shone at her throat and ears. She blinked at me when I peered at the door. "Harry?" I stared at her. Oh, my gosh. I'd forgotten my date with Susan. How in the world could I have forgotten that? I mean, the White Council, the police, vampires, concussions, junkies, mob bosses, and the baseball bat-swinging thugs notwithstanding. Well, no. There probably wasn't any woman incredible enough to keep my mind on them through all of that. But all the same, it seemed a little rude of me. "Hi, Susan," I said lamely. I peered past her. When had Susan said she was going to show up? 9? And when had Linda said? 8? No, wait. She had said 8 o'clock at first, and then she had said she'd come by in another hour after that, at 9. Oh, boy. This was not going to be pretty. Susan read me like a book and glanced back behind her at the rain before looking back up at me. "Expecting someone, Harry?" "Not exactly," I told her. "Well, maybe. Look, come on in, you're getting drenched." Which wasn't exactly true. I was getting drenched. my bare feet soaked, standing there in the open door, the wind blowing rain down the stairwell at me. Susan's mouth quirked in a malicious, predatory smile, and she came in, folding down her umbrella and brushing past me. "This is your apartment?" "Nah," I told her, "this is my summer house in Zurich." She eyed me as I closed the door, took her coat, and hung it up on a tall, old wooden hat stand near the doorway. Susan turned away from me as I hung up her coat. Her dress showed her back, the long curve of her spine all the way down to her waist. It had a fairly tame hemline and long, tight sleeves. I liked it. A lot. She let me see her back for a while as she walked away from me toward the fireplace, and then slowly turned to face me, smirking, leaning one smooth hip on the couch. Her midnight hair was bound up on top of her head, displaying a long and slender neck. Her skin, an advertisement for something smooth and wonderful. Her lips quirked up at the corner, and she narrowed her dark, flashing eyes at me. "The police having you put in overtime, Harry?" she drawled. "The killings must be sensational. Major crime figure, murdered with magic. Care to make a statement?" I winced. She was still hunting for an angle for the arcane. "Sure," I told her. Her eyes widened in surprise. "I need a shower," I said. "I'll be right back. Mister, keep an eye on the lady, eh?" Susan gave me a little roll of her eyes and then glanced up at the studied mister on his perch on the bookcase. Mister, for his part, flicked an ear and continued staring at the door. More thunder rumbled overhead. I lit a few candles for her, and then took one with me into the bathroom. "Think, Harry. Get awake. Get your head clear. What to do?" "Get clean," I told myself. "You smell like a horse. Get some cool water over your head and work this out. Linda Randall is going to be here in a minute, and you need to figure out how to keep Susan from prying her nose into the business of the murders." So advised, I agreed with myself and hurriedly got undressed and into the shower. I don't use a water heater, and consequently I am more than used to cold showers. Actually, given how often I, and wizards in general, get to date actual real women, maybe that's just as well. I was lathering up with shampoo when the lightning got a lot worse. The thunder a lot louder. The rain a lot harder. The height of the storm had hit the old house, and it hit hard. It was almost impossible to see clearly in the violent electrical discharge, almost impossible to hear over the thunder. But I caught a flicker of motion out of the corner of my eye, a shadow that moved across the sunken window, covered by modest curtains, in the bathroom. Someone was moving towards the stairs down to my apartment. Did I mention how I haven't had a ton of success with women? Nights like this one are a reason why. I panicked, hard. I leapt out of the shower, my head all a-sudsy, wrapped a towel around my waist, and headed out into the front room. I couldn't let Linda just come to the door and have Susan answer it. That would be the cattiest thing you've ever seen, and I would be the one to get all the scratches and bites, too. I rounded the corner from my bedroom into the main room and saw Susan reaching for the doorknob. Lightning flashed again, and thunder kept me from hearing the knob's click-clack. I heard something else, though, a snarling, spitting sound, and saw Mister on his feet now, his back arched up and all his fur fluffed out, teeth bared, his no longer sleepy eyes fastened on the door. The thunder passed as Susan swung the door open. I could see her face in profile. One hand was on her hip, and there was an amused, dangerous little smile on her pretty mouth. As the door opened, I felt it. The cloud of energies that accompanies a spiritual being when it comes into the mortal world, disguised until now by the background clutter of the storm. A figure stood in the doorway, rather squat, less than 5 feet tall, dressed in a plain brown trench coat illuminated by the blue lightning overhead. There was something wrong to the shape. Something that just wasn't part of good old Mother Earth. Its head turned to look at me, and sudden twin points of fire, as blue as the lightning dancing above, flared up, illuminating the leathery, inhuman curves of a face that most closely resembled that of a large and warty toad. Susan got a good look at the demon's eyes and face from 2 feet away and screamed. "Susan!" I shouted, moving already towards the couch. "Get out of the way!" I threw myself on the floor behind the couch, landing with a whoomph of hard floor hitting my ribs. The demon's jaws parted in a silent hiss, and its throat constricted weirdly as I vanished behind the couch. There was a hissing sound, and a heart-sized section of the couch just dissolved in a cloud of mist and foul stench. Droplets of liquid spattered through onto the floor near me, and where they touched, little holes corroded outward in the space of 2 seconds. I rolled away from the couch and the demon's acid. "Susan," I shouted, "get back towards the kitchen. Don't get between it and me." "What is it?" she screamed back at me. "A bad guy." I poked my head up and peered through the smoking hole in the couch, ready to duck back at a moment's notice. The demon, squat and bulkier than a human, was standing in the doorway, both long-fingered, pad-tipped hands leaning forward towards the inside of the house. It paused as though resting against a light screen. "Why isn't it coming in?" Susan asked from the far corner near the door. Her back was pressed to the walls, and her eyes were wide and terrified. "My God," I thought, "just don't pass out on me, Susan." "Homestead laws," I said. "It isn't a mortal creature. It has to gather its energy to push through the barrier around the home." "Can it get in?" she said. Her voice was thin and reedy. She was asking questions, gathering information, data, falling back on her ingrained career instincts because, I suspected, her rational brain had short-circuited. That happens to people who get a hard look at a demon for the first time. I hurried over to her and grabbed her arm, dragging her back towards the door leading down to my lab. "Get down there," I shouted, jerking the door up and revealing a folding ladder staircase. "It's dark," Susan protested. "Oh, God," she blinked down at my waist. "Harry, why are you naked?" I looked down and blushed. The towel must have fallen off while I was dancing around. Looking down me, the shampoo suds still in my hair runneled down into my eyes, making them sting and burn. Could this evening get any worse? There was a tearing sound from the doorway, and the toad demon sort of surged forward, a stumbling step. It was now in my house, lightning still dancing in the sky behind it, and I could see it only in ugly, hunched-backed outline, except for the electric light of its wide, round, googly eyes as it came toward me. Its throat was working in little, undulating motions. "Crap," I said. I'm quite eloquent in times of crisis. I shoved Susan towards the stairs and turned toward the demon, tips of my fingers touching, fingers spread, palms out towards it. The demon's mouth opened again, and it made a slick, spittooning sound. "Vento reflitum," I shouted, willing my fear and anxiety into a tangible shape, throwing it down from my pounding heart through my shoulders and arms, directing it at the foe. The globule of demon acid sped towards my face. My terror and adrenaline roared out of my fingertips in the form of wind, gathering up speed enough to tear the hair from a man's head. It caught the blob of acid and flung it back at the demon in a fine spray, stopped the thing in its tracks, and even drove it back several feet, its claw-tipped feet sliding on my smooth floor, catching on the rugs. The acid sizzled and spat little electric blue sparks on its skin, but it didn't seem to harm the demon. It did, however, dissolve the trench coat into shreds in less time than it takes to draw a breath and wreaked havoc on my rugs and furniture. The demon shook its head, gathering its wits. I turned to the far corner, near the door, and extended my hand, trumpeting, "Vento servitas!" The pale, smooth wood of my wizard's staff all but glowed in the darkness as it flew towards me, driven by a gentler, finer blast of the same wind. I caught it in my hand and spun towards the demon, calling on the lines of power and force deep within the long, unbroken grains of the wood in the staff. I extended the staff towards it, horizontally like a bar, and shouted, "Out! Out! Out! You are not welcome here!" A touch dramatic in any other circumstance, maybe, but when you've got a demon in your living room, nothing seems too extreme. The toad demon hunched its shoulders, planted its broad feet, and grunted as a wave of unseen force swept out from my staff like a broom whisking along the floor. I could feel the demon resisting me, pressing against the strength of the staff as though I were leaning in the wood against a vertical steel bar and attempting to snap it across the length. We strained, silently for several seconds until I realized that this thing was just too strong for me. I wasn't going to be able to brush it off like a minor imp or a niggling poltergeist. It wouldn't take me long to exhaust myself, and once the demon could move again, it was either going to dissolve me with its acid or else just waddle up to me and rip me to pieces. It would be stronger than a mortal, a hell of a lot faster, and it was not going to stop until I was dead, or the sun came up, or one of any of a number of other unlikely conditions were met. "Susan," I shouted, my chest heaving, "are you down there?" "Yes," she said. "Is it gone?" "Not exactly, no." I felt my palms get sweaty, and the smooth wood of the staff begin to slip. The burning of the soap suds in my eyes increased, and the light of the demon's eyes brightened. "Why don't you set it on fire? Shoot it. Blow it up." Her voice had a searching quality to it, as though she were looking around, down there in the lab. "I can't," I said to her. I can't pump enough juice into it to hurt the thing without blowing us up along with it. You've got to get out of there. My mind was racing along, calculating possibilities, numbers, my reserves of energy, cold and rational. The thing was here for me. If I drew it off to one side, into my bedroom or bathroom, Susan might be able to escape. On the other hand, it might be under orders to kill me and any witnesses, in which case, after it finished me, it would simply go after her as well. There had to be another way to get her out of here, and then I remembered it. Susan, I shouted, there's a sports bottle on my table down there. Drink what's in it and think about being away from here, okay? Think about being far away. I found it, she called up a second later. It smells bad. Damn it, it's a potion. It'll get you out of here. Drink it. There was a gagging noise, and then a moment later she said, now what? I blinked and looked at the stairs going down. It should have worked. I broke off as the toad thing leaned forward, reaching out a clawed foot, and in that stride gained 3 feet of ground toward me. I was able to stop it again, barely, but I knew that it was going to be coming for my throat in a few more seconds. Nothing happened, she said. Damn it, Harry, we have to do something. And then she came pounding up the ladder, dark eyes flashing, my .38 revolver in her hand. No, I told her, don't. I felt the staff slip more. The demon was getting ready to come through all my defenses. Susan raised the gun, face pale, her hands shaking, and started shooting. The .38 Chief's Special carries 6 rounds, and I use a medium-speed load rather than armor-piercing or explosive bullets or anything fancy like that. Fewer chances that something will go wrong in the presence of a lot of magic. A gun is a pretty simple machine. A revolver approach is very simple. Wheels, gears, and a simple lever impact to ignite the powder. It's tough for magic to argue with physics most of the time. The revolver roared 6 times. The first 2 shots must have gone wide and hit somewhere else. The next 2 struck the demon's hide and made deep dents in it before springing off and rebounding wildly around the room, as I had feared they would, more of a threat to us than to it. Fortunately, neither of us were injured or killed by the ricochets. The 5th shot went between its long, oddly shaped legs and past it. The 6th hit the thing square between its lightning lantern eyes, knocking it off balance and sent it tumbling over with a toady hiss of frustration. I gasped and grabbed Susan's wrist. Basement, I wheezed, as she dropped the gun. We both scrambled down the ladder. I didn't bother to shut it behind me. The thing could just tear its way through the door if it needed to. This way, I would at least know where it was coming down, rather than have it tunnel through the floor and come down on top of my head. At my will, the tip of the staff I held burst into light, illuminating the room. Harry? Bob's voice came from the shelf. The skull's eyelights came on, and he swiveled his face to me. What the hell is going on? Who's the babe? Susan jumped. What was that? Ignore him, I said, and followed my own advice. I went to the far end of my lab table and started kicking boxes, bags, notebooks, and old paperbacks off the floor. Help me clear this floor space. Hurry. She did, and I cursed the lack of cleaning skills that had left this end of the lab such a mess. I was struggling to get to the circle I had laid in the floor, a perfect ring of copper, an unbroken loop on the concrete that could be empowered to hold a demon in or out. Harry, Bob gulped as we worked. There's, a seriously badass toad demon coming down the ladder. I know that, Bob. I heaped a bunch of empty cardboard boxes aside as Susan frantically tossed some papers away, exposing the entirety of the copper ring about 3 feet across. I took her hand and stepped into the circle, drawing her close to me. What's happening? Susan asked, her expression bewildered and terrified. Just stay close, I told her. She clung tightly to me. It sees you, Harry, Bob reported. It's going to spit something at you, I think. I didn't have time to see if Bob was right. I leaned down, touched the circle with the tip of my staff, and willed power into it to shut the creature out. The circle sprung around us, a silent and invisible tension in the air. Something splattered and hissed against the air a few inches from my face. I looked up to see dark, sputtering acid slithering off the invisible shield the circle's power provided us. Half a second earlier, it would have eaten my face off, Cheery thought. I tried to catch my breath, stand straight, and not let any part of me extend outside the circle, which would break its circuit and negate its power. My arms were shaking, my legs were weak. Susan, too, was visibly trembling. The demon stalked over to us. I could see it clearly in the light of my staff. I wished that I couldn't. It was horribly ugly, misshapen, foul, heavily muscled, and I compared it to a toad, only because I knew of nothing else that even remotely approached a description of it. It glared at me and drove a fist at the circle's shield. It rebounded in a shower of blue sparks, and the thing hissed a horrible and windy sound. Outside, the storm continued to rumble, muffled by the thick walls of the sub-basement. Susan was holding close to me and almost crying. Why isn't it killing us? Why isn't it getting us? It can't, I said gently. It can't get through. It can't do anything to break the circle. So long as neither of us crosses that line, we'll be safe. Oh, God, Susan said. How long do we have to stand here? Dawn, I said. Until dawn. When the sun rises, it has to go. There's no sun down here, she said. Doesn't work that way. It's got a sort of a power cord stretching back to whoever summoned it, a fuel line. As soon as the sun comes up, that line is cut, and he goes away like a balloon with no air. When does the sun come up? She asked. Oh, well, about 10 more hours. Oh, she said. She laid her head against my bare chest and closed her eyes. The toad demon paced in a slow circuit around the circle, searching for a weakness in the shield. It could find none. I closed my eyes and tried to think. Harry, Bob began. Not now, Bob. But Harry, Bob tried again. Damn it, Bob, I'm trying to think. If you want to be really useful, you can try to figure out why the escape potion you were so confident of didn't work for Susan. Harry, Bob protested, that's what I'm trying to tell you. Susan murmured against my chest. Is it getting warm in here, or is it just me? A terrible suspicion struck me. I looked down at Susan and got a sinking feeling. Surely not, no. It couldn't be. She looked up at me, her dark eyes smoky. We're going to die, aren't we, Harry? Have you ever thought you want to die making love? She kissed my chest, almost absently. It felt nice. Really, really nice. I tried not to notice all the bare, lovely back that was naked underneath my hand. I've thought that many times, she said, against my skin. I shivered. Bob, I began, my voice getting furious. I tried to tell you, Bob wailed. I did. She grabbed the wrong potion and just chugged it down. Bob's skull turned toward me a bit. The lights brightened. You've got to admit, though, the love potion works great. Susan was kissing my chest and rubbing her body up against me in a fashion that was unladylike and extremely pleasant and distracting. Bob, I swear I'm going to lock you in a wall safe for the next 200 years. It's not my fault, Bob protested. The demon watched what was happening in the circle with froggy eyes and kicked a section of the floor clear enough of debris for it to squat down on its hunches and stare, restless and ready as a cat waiting for a mouse to stick its head out of its hole. Susan stared up at me with sultry eyes and tried to wrench me to the floor and consequently out of the circle's protective power. Bob continued to wail his innocence. Who says I don't know how to show a lady a good time? Susan tugged at my neck and jerked my head down to hers for a kiss. As kisses went, well, it was extremely interesting. Perfectly passionate, abandoned, not a trace of self-consciousness or hesitation to it, or at any rate not from her. I came up for air a minute later, my lips itching with the intensity of it, and she stared up at me with intent, burning eyes. Take me, Harry. I need you. Susan, this isn't really a good time right now, I said. The potion had taken hold of her. No wonder she had recovered from her terror enough to come back up the stairs and fire my gun at the demon. It had lowered her inhibitions to a sufficient degree. It must have also dulled her fears. Susan's fingers wandered. Her eyes sparkled. Your mouth says no, she purred. But this says yes. I went up on my toes and swallowed, trying to keep my balance and get her hand off me at the same time. That thing always says something stupid, I told her. She was beyond reason. The potion had kicked her libido into suicidal overdrive. Bob, help me out of here. I'm stuck in a skull, Bob said. If you don't let me out, I can't do much of anything, Harry. Susan stood up on tiptoe to gnaw at my ear, wrapped her shapely thigh around one of mine, and started whimpering and pulling me toward the floor. My balance wavered. A 3-foot circle is not enough to perform wrestling or gymnastics or anything else, and not leave something sticking out for the waiting demon to chew on. Is the other potion still there? I asked. Sure, Bob said. I can see it where it fell on the floor. Could throw it to you, too. Okay, I said, growing excited. Well, more excited. I might get out of this basement alive. I'm going to let you out for 5 minutes. I want you to help me by throwing the potion. No, boss, Bob said, his voice maddeningly cheerful.
No, no. I get a 24-hour leave or nothing. Damn it, Bob, I'm responsible for what you do if I let you out. You know that.
Susan whispered into my ear, I'm not wearing any underwear, and tried something approximating a pro-wrestling takedown to drop me to the floor. I wavered in balance and barely managed to stave her off. The demon's frog eyes narrowed, and it came to its feet, ready to leap on us.
Bob, I yelled, you slimy jerk. You try living in a bony old skull for a few hundred years, Harry. You want to get a night off once in a while, too.
Fine, I shouted, my heart leaping into my throat as my balance wavered again.
Fine, just make sure you get me the potion. You have 24 hours.
Just make sure you catch it, Bob replied, and then a flood of orangish light flowed out of both of the skull's eye sockets and into the room. They swooped down in an elongated cloud over the potion bottle that lay on the floor at the far side of the lab, gathered it up, and hurled it through the air towards me. I reached up with my spare hand and caught it, bobbled it for a minute, and then secured it again. The orange lights that were Bob's spirit form danced a little jig and whizzed up the ladder and out of the lab, vanishing.
What's that?
Susan murmured, eyes dazed. Another drink, I said. Drink this with me. I think I can cover us both in the focus department. Get us both out of here.
Harry, she said, I'm not thirsty.
Her eyes smoldered.
I'm hungry.
I hit upon an idea. Once we drink this, I'll be ready, and we can go to bed. She looked up at me hazily and smiled, wicked and delighted.
Oh, Harry, bottoms up.
Her hands made a sort of silent commentary on her words, and I jumped, almost dropping the bottle. More shampoo from my hair trailed down my already burning eyes, and I squeezed them closed. I slugged away about half the potion, trying to ignore the flat cola taste, and quickly passed the rest to Susan. She smiled lazily and drank it down, licking her lips. It started in my guts, a sort of fluttery, wobbly feeling, then moved out, up through my lungs and out along my shoulders, down my arms. It also went down over my hips and into my legs. I began to shake and quiver uncontrollably, and then I just flew apart into a cloud of a million billion tiny pieces of Harry, each one with its own perspective and view. The room wasn't just a square cluttered basement to me, but a pattern of energies grouped into specific shapes and uses. Even the demon was a cloud of particles, slow and dense. I flowed around that cloud, up through the opening in the ceiling pattern, and outside of the apartment into the raging non-pattern of the storm. It took maybe 5 seconds, and the power of the potion faded. I felt all the tiny pieces of me abruptly rush back together and slam into one another at unthinkable speed. It hurt. It made me nauseous. A sort of heavy-duty thump of impact that didn't come from any one direction, but from every direction at once. I staggered, planted my staff on the ground, and felt the rain wash down over me. Susan appeared next to me a heartbeat later, and promptly sat down on her butt on the ground in the rain.
Oh, God, I feel terrible.
Inside the apartment, the demon screamed, a raging, voiceless hiss. I could hear it, madly rampaging around inside.
Come on, I told her. We've got to get out of here before it gets smart and starts looking outside for us.
I'm sick, she said. I'm not sure I can walk.
The mixed potions, I said. That can do that to you, but we have to go now. Come on, Susan, up and at 'em. I bent down and got her up on her feet and moved away from my apartment.
Where are we going?
She asked. Do you have your car keys? She patted her dress as if looking for pockets, then shook her head, dazedly.
They were in my coat pocket.
We walk, then.
Walk where?
Over to Reading Road. It always floods when there's this much rain. It'll be enough water to ground the thing if it tries to follow us. I started her moving. It was only a couple of blocks away. The cold rain came down in buckets. I was shaking, shivering, and naked. And more soap was getting into my eyes. But hey, at least I was clean.
What? She mumbled. What will the rain do to it?
Not rain, running water. It kills him if he tries to go over it after us, I explained to her patiently. I hoped the potions mixing together in her stomach hadn't done anything irreversible. There had been accidents before. We were moving at good speed, all things considered, and had covered maybe 40 yards in the pouring rain. Not much farther to go.
Oh, that's good, she said,
and then she convulsed and pitched to the ground. I tried to hold her, but I was just too tired and my arms too weak. I nearly went down with her. She rolled to her side and lay that way, retching horribly, vomiting herself empty. Thunder and lightning raged around us again. I heard the sharp crack of the storm's power touching a tree nearby. I saw the bright flash of contact and then the subdued glow of burning branches. I looked on in the direction we'd been heading, the flooding Reading Road. Safety from the demon was still 30 yards away.
I didn't think it'd last this long,
someone said. I almost jumped out of my skin. I picked my staff up in both hands and turned in a slow circle, searching for the source of the voice.
Who's there?
There, to one side, a spot of cold, not physical cold, but something deeper and darker than my other senses detected. A pooling of shadows, an illusion in the darkness between lights, gone when lightning flashed and back again when it had passed.
Do you expect me to give you my name? The shadows scorned. Suffice to say, I am the one who has killed you.
You're an underachiever, I shot back, still turning, eyes searching. The job's not done. In the darkness, underneath a broken streetlight then, maybe 20 feet away, I could make out a shape of a person. Man or woman, I couldn't tell, nor could I distinguish from the voice.
Soon, the voice said. You can't last much longer. My demon will finish you before another 10 minutes have passed.
The voice was supremely confident.
You called that demon here?
Indeed, the shadowy shape confirmed.
Are you crazy?
I demanded, stunned. Don't you know what could happen if that thing gets loose? It won't, the shape assured me. It's mine to control. I extended my senses toward the shape and found what I had suspected was true. It wasn't a real person, or an illusion masking a real person. It was only a seeming of one. A phantasm of shape and sound. A hologram that could see and hear and speak for its creator, wherever he or she was.
What are you doing?
It demanded. It must have sensed me feeling it out. Checking your credentials, I said, and sent some of my remaining will towards it, the sorcerer's equivalent of a slap in the face. The image cried out in surprise and reeled back.
How did you do that?
It snarled. I went to school. The image growled and then raised up its voice, calling out in rolling syllables. I tried to hear what had been said, but another peal of thunder blocked out the middle half of what was undoubtedly the demon's name. From within my apartment, the distant, faint sound of the demon's smashing ruckus came to an abrupt halt.
Now, the image said, a sneer to its voice. Now you will pay. Why are you doing this? I demanded. You're in my way. Let the woman go.
Sorry, the image said. She's seen too much. She's in the way too now. My demon will kill you both.
You bastard, I snarled. It laughed at me.
I looked over my shoulder, back towards the apartment. Through the rain I heard a dry and raspy hiss, underlaid with a sort of clicking growl. Blue frog eyes, reflecting the storm's lightning, came up the stairs from my basement's apartment. It focused on me immediately and started forward. The back fender of Susan's car, which she had parked outside my apartment, got in its way, and with the pad-tipped fingers of one skinny, soft-looking hand, it picked up the back of the car and tossed it to one side, where it landed with a heavy crunch. I tried not to think of those fingers around my throat.
You see, the image said, mine to call. Time for you to die. Mr. Dresden.
Another flash of lightning showed the demon falling to all floors and scrambling towards me, like an overweight lizard scuttling across hot sand to shade, in an extreme wagging motion that looked ridiculous, but brought it closer and closer at deceptive speed.
Deposit another quarter and continue your call, asshole, I said.
I thrust my staff towards the shadowy figure, this time focusing my will into a full-fledged attack.
Stragalum finitas.
Scarlet light abruptly flooded over it, devouring its edges and moving inward. The image snarled, then gasped in pain.
Dresden, my demon will roll in your bones!
And then it broke off into a scream of anguish as my counterspell began to tear the image sending apart. I was better than whoever made the image, and whoever they were, they couldn't hold the spell in the face of my counter. The image and the scream alike faded slowly into the distance until both were gone. I allowed myself the smallest touch of satisfaction and turned to the woman on the ground. Susan, I said, crouching by her, keeping my eyes on the onrushing demon. Susan, get up. We have to go.
I can't, she sobbed. Oh, God.
She threw up some more. She tried to rise, but collapsed back on the ground, moaning piteously. I looked back at the water, gauging the thing's speed. It was coming, fast, but not quite as fast as a man could run. I could still escape it if I ran, full out. I could get across the water. I could be safe. But I couldn't carry Susan there. I'd never make it with her slowing me down. But if I didn't go, both of us would die. Did both of us have to die? Wouldn't it be better for one of us at least to live? I looked back at the demon. I was exhausted, and it had caught me unprepared. The heavy rain would keep fire, man's ancient weapon against the darkness and the things it hid, from being effective in holding it back. I didn't have enough left in me to do anything else. It would be as good as suicide to stand against it. Susan sobbed on the ground, helpless in the rain, sick from my potions, unable to rise. I leaned my head back and let the rain wash the last traces of shampoo from my eyes, my hair. Then I turned, took a step towards the oncoming demon. I couldn't leave Susan to that thing, not even if it meant dying. I'd never be able to live with myself afterwards. The demon squalled something at me in its hissing, toady voice and raised up both of its hands toward me, coming up onto its hind legs. Lightning flashed overhead, blinding bright. Thunder came hard on its heels, deep enough to shake the street beneath my bare feet. Thunder, lightning. The storm. I looked up at the boiling clouds overhead, lit by the dancing lightning moving among them, deadly beautiful and luminous. Power seethed and danced in the storm, mystic energies as old as time, enough power to shatter stones, superheat air, boil water to steam, burn anything it touches to ashes. At this point, I think it's safe to say I was desperate enough to try anything. The demon howled and waddled forward, clumsy and quick. I raised my staff to the sky with one hand, and with the other pointed a finger at the demon. This was dangerous work, tapping the storm. There was no ritual to give it shape, no circle to protect me, not even words to shield my mind from the way the energies of magic would course through it. I sent my senses coursing upwards towards the storm, taking hold of the formless powers and drawing them into patterns of raw energy that began to surge toward me, toward the tip of my staff.
"Harry," Susan said, "what are you doing?"
She huddled on the ground in her evening dress, shuddering. Her voice was weak, thready.
"You ever form a line of people holding hands when you were a kid and scuff your feet across the carpet together and then have the last person in the line touch someone in the ear to zap them?"
"Yeah,"
she said, confused.
"I'm doing that, only bigger."
The demon squalled again and drove itself into the air with its powerful toad legs, hurtling towards me, sailing through the air with a frightening and unnatural grace. I focused what little I had left of my will on the staff and the clouds and the raging power above.
"Ventas," I shouted. "Ventas fulmino."
At my will, a spark leapt from the tip of my staff toward the clouds above. It touched the rolling, restless belly of the storm. Hell roared down in response. Lightning, white, hot fury, with a torrent of wind and rain, all fell upon me, centered around my staff. I felt the power hit the end of the soaking wet wood with a jolt like a sledgehammer. It coursed down the staff and into my hand, making my muscles convulse, bowing my naked body with the strain. It took everything I had to hold the image of what I wanted in my mind, to keep my hand pointed at the demon as it came for me, to keep the energy surging on through me to wreak its havoc on flesh less tender than mine. The demon was maybe 6 inches away when the storm's fury boiled down my body and out through my arm, out of my pointing finger, and took it in the heart. The force of it threw the thing back, back and up, into the air, and held it there, wreathed in a corona of blinding energy. The demon struggled, screaming, toad hands flailing, toad legs kicking. And then it exploded in a wash of blue flame. The night was lit once more, bright as day. I had to shield my eyes against it. Susan cried out in fear, and I think I must have been screaming along with her. The night grew quiet again. Flaming bits of something I didn't want to think about were raining down on us, landing with little wet plopping sounds upon the road and sidewalk, the yards of the houses around me, burning quickly to little briquettes of charcoal, and then hissing into sputtering coolness. The wind abruptly died down. The rain slowed to a gentle patter, the storm's fury spent. My legs gave out, and I sat shakily on the street, stunned. My hair was dry and was standing on end. There was smoke curling up from the blackened ends of my toenails. I just sat there, happy to be alive, to be breathing in and out again. I felt like I could crawl back to bed and go to sleep for a few days, even though I'd gotten up not a half an hour ago. Susan sat there, blinking, her face blank. She stared at me.
"What are you doing next Saturday?"
I asked her. She just kept on staring for a minute, and then quietly laid down again on her side. I heard the footsteps approach me from the darkness off to one side.
Summoning demons, a sour voice, disgusted. In addition to the atrocities you have already committed, I knew I smelled black magic on the winds tonight. You are a blight, Dresden.
I sort of rolled my head over to one side to regard Morgan, my warden, tall and massive in his black trench coat. The rain had plastered his gray hair down to his head and coursed down the lines of his face like channels in a slab of stone.
I didn't call that thing, I said, my voice slurred with fatigue, but I damn well sent it back to where it belongs, didn't you see?
I saw you defend yourself against it, Morgan said,
but I didn't see anyone else summon it up. You probably called it up yourself and lost control of it. It couldn't have taken me anyway, Dresden. It wouldn't have done you any good.
I laughed weakly. You flatter yourself, I said. I sure as hell wouldn't risk calling up a demon just to get to you, Morgan.
He narrowed his already narrow eyes. I have convened the council, he said. They will be here 2 dawns hence.
They will hear my testimony, Dresden, and the evidence I have to present to them against you.
There was another more subdued flash of lightning, and it gave his eyes a wild madman's gleam.
And then they will order you put to death.
I just stared at him for a moment, dully.
The council, I said, they're coming here? To Chicago?
Morgan smiled at me, the kind of smile sharks reserve for baby seals.
Dawn on Monday.
You will be brought before them. I don't usually enjoy my position as executioner, Harry Blackstone Copperfield Dresden, but in your case, I'm proud to fulfill the role.
I shuddered when he pronounced my full name. He did it almost exactly right. Maybe by accident, and maybe not, too.
There were those on the White Council who knew my name, knew how to say it. To run from the council convened, to avoid them, would be to admit guilt and invite disaster. And because they knew my name, they could find me, they could get to me, anywhere.
Susan moaned and stirred.
Harry, she mumbled. What happened?
I turned to her to make sure she was all right. When I glanced back over my shoulder, Morgan was gone. Susan sneezed and then huddled against me. I put my arm around her to share what little warmth I had.
Monday morning. Monday morning.
Morgan would bring his suspicions and level his accusations, and it would likely be enough to get me voted dead. Whoever Mr. or Miss Shadows was, I had to find him, her, it, or them before Monday morning, or I was as good as dead. I was reflecting on what a miserable date I was when the squad car pulled up, turned on its spotlights on us, and the officer said, over the loudspeaker,
"Set the stick down and put your hands up. Don't make any sudden moves."
Perfectly natural, I thought, embracing a sort of exhausted stoicism, for an officer to arrest a naked man and a woman dressed in an evening gown, sitting on a sidewalk in pouring rain, like a couple of drunks fresh off a bender. Susan shielded her eyes and then looked out at the spotlight. All the throwing up she'd done must have gotten rid of the potion in her, ended its amorous effects.
"This," she said in a calm and dispassionate voice, "is the worst night of my life."
The officers got out of the car and started toward us. I grunted.
"Yeah, that's what you get for trying to go out with a wizard."
She glanced aside at me. Her eyes glittered darkly for a moment. She almost smiled, and there was a sort of vindictive satisfaction to her tone when she spoke. "But it's going to make a fantastic story."
As it turned out, Linda Randall had a darn good reason for skipping out on our appointment Saturday night. Linda Randall was dead. I sneezed as I ducked under the yellow police tape in the sweatpants and t-shirt I had been allowed to pluck from the mess of my place before the police car had brought me across town to Linda Randall's apartment, and cowboy boots. Mister had dragged one of my sneakers off, and I hadn't had time to find it, so I wore what I had. Freaking cat. Linda had died a bit earlier that evening. After getting to the scene, Murphy had tried to phone me, failed to get through, and then sent a squad car down to pick me up and bring me in to do my consulting bit. The dutiful patrolman sent to collect me had stopped to check out the crazy naked guy a block away from my apartment and had been surprised and more than a little suspicious when I turned out to be the very same man they were supposed to pick up and bring to the crime scene. Dear Susan had come to my rescue, explaining away what had happened as just one of those things, tee-hee, and assuring the officers that she was all right and would be fine to drive home. She got a little pale around the edges when she saw once more the ruins of my apartment and the enormous dent the demon had put on the side of her car, but she made a bold face of it and eventually left the scene with that "I've got a story to write" gleam in her eye. She stopped and gave me a kiss on the cheek on her way out and whispered, "Not bad, Harry," in my ear. Then she patted my bare ass and got in her car. I blushed. I don't think the cops noticed it, in the rain, in the dark. The patrolmen looked at me askance, but were more than happy to let me put on some fresh clothes. The only things I had clean were more sweats and another T-shirt, this one proclaiming in bold letters over a little cartoon graveyard, "Easter has been canceled. They found the body." I put those on, and my duster, which had somehow survived the demon attack, and my utterly inappropriate cowboy boots. And then I had gotten into the patrol car and been driving across town. I clipped my little ID card to my coat's lapel and followed the uniforms in. One of them led me to Murphy. On the way, I took in the details. There were a lot of people standing around gawking. It was still fairly early, after all. The rain came down in a fine mist and softened the contours of the scene. There were several police cars parked in the apartment building's parking lots, and one on the lawn by the door leading out to the little concrete patio from the apartment in question. Someone had left his bulbs on. The blue lights flashed over the scene in alternating swathes of shadow and cold light. There was a lot of yellow police tape around. And right in the middle of it all was Murphy. She looked terrible, like she hadn't eaten anything that didn't come out of a vending machine or drunk anything but stale coffee since I had seen her last. Her blue eyes were tired and bloodshot, but still sharp. "Dresden," she said. She peered up at me. "You planning on having King Kong climb your hair?" I tried to smile at her. "Yeah, we still need to cast our screaming damsel. Interested?" Murphy snorted. She snorts really well for someone with such a cute nose. "Come on." She spun on one heel and walked up to the apartment, as though she wasn't exhausted and at the end of her rope. The forensic team was already there, so we got some nifty plastic booties to put on over our shoes and loose plastic gloves for our hands from an officer standing beside the door. "I tried to call earlier," Murphy said, "but your phone was out of service. Again, Harry." "Bad night for it," I responded, wobbling as I slipped the booties on. "What's the story?" "Another victim," she said. "Same M.O. as Tommy Tom and the Stanton woman." "Jesus," I said. "They're using the storms." "What?" Murphy turned and fixed her eyes on me. "The storm," I repeated. "You can tap storms and other natural phenomena to get things done. All natural fuel for the mojo." "You didn't say anything about that before," Murphy accused. "I hadn't thought of it until tonight." I rubbed my face. It made sense. Hell's bells. That was how the Shadow Man had been able to do all of that in one night. He'd called the demon and been able to send it after me, as well as appearing in the shadow he'd projected. And he'd been able to kill again. "Have you got an ID on the victim?" I asked. Murphy turned to go inside as she answered. "Linda Randall, chauffeur, age 29. It was a good thing Murphy had turned away, or the way my jaw dropped would have told her I knew the deceased, and she would have had all sorts of uncomfortable questions. I stared at Murphy for a second, then hurriedly veiled my expression and followed her inside the apartment. Linda Randall's one-bedroom apartment looked like the trailer of a rock band that did little besides play concerts, host parties, and fall into a stupor afterwards. Dirty clothes were strewn on one side of a king-sized bed. There was a disproportionate amount of clothing that looked as though it had been purchased from a Fredericks of Hollywood catalog. Lacy and silky and satiny colors. All bright, designed to attract the eye. There were many candles around the bed, on shelves and dressers and a night table, most burned halfway down. The drawer of the night table was partly open, revealing a number of personal amusements. Linda Randall had, apparently, liked her toys. The kitchenette, off to one side, looked largely unused, except for the coffee pot, the microwave, and the trash can, in which several pizza boxes were crammed. Maybe it was the pizza boxes that did it. Gave me a sudden pang of understanding, empathy for Linda. My own kitchen looked the same a lot of the time, minus the microwave. Here lived someone else who knew what it was to know that the only thing waiting home was a sense of loneliness. Sometimes it's comforting. Most often it isn't. I'll bet Linda would have understood that. But I'd never have a chance to know. The forensics team was gathered around the bed, concealing whatever was there like a cluster of buzzards around the exposed head of the outlaws they used to bury up to their necks in the Old West. They spoke among themselves in low, calm voices, dispassionate as skilled dinner chatter, calling little details to the attention of their companions, complimenting one another on their observations. "Harry," Murphy said quietly, her tone of voice suggesting that it wasn't the first time she said it. "Are you sure you're all right for this?" My mouth twitched. Of course I wasn't all right for this. No one should ever be all right for this sort of thing. But instead of saying that, I told her, "My head's just aching. Sorry. Let's just get it over with." She nodded and led me over toward the bed. Murphy was a lot shorter than most of the men and women working around the bed, but I had almost a head of height on all of them, so I didn't have to ask anyone to move. Just stepped up close to the bed and looked. Linda had been on the phone when she died. She was naked. Even this early in the year, she had tan lines around her hips. She must have gone to a tanning booth during the winter. Her hair was still damp. She lay on her back, her eyes half closed, her expression tranquil, as it hadn't been any time I'd seen her. Her heart had been torn out. It was laying on the king-sized bed about a foot and a half from her, pulped and squashed and slippery, sort of a scarlet and gray color. There was a hole in her chest, too, showing where the bone had been splintered outward by the force that had removed her heart. I just stared a few moments, noting the details in a sort of detached way. Again. Again, someone had used magic to end a life. I had to think of her as she sounded on the phone, joking, a quick wit, a sort of sly sensuality in the way she said her words and phrased her sentences, a little hint of insecurity around the edges, vulnerability that magnified the other parts of her personality. Her hair was damp because she'd been taking a bath before she came to see me. Whatever anyone said of her, she had been passionately, vitally alive. Had been. Eventually, I realized how quiet the room was. The men and women of the forensics team, all five of them, were looking up at me, waiting. As I looked down, they all averted their gazes, but you didn't have to be a wizard to see what was in their faces. Fear, pure and simple. They had been faced with something science couldn't explain. It rattled them, shook them to their cores, the sudden, violent, and bloody evidence that 300 years of science and research was no match for the things that were still, even after all this time, lurking in the dark. And I was the one who was supposed to have the answers. I didn't have any for them, and I felt like a shit for remaining silent as I stepped back and turned away from Linda's body, then walked across the room to the small bathroom. The tub was still full of water. A bracelet and earrings were laid out on a counter in front of a mirror, plus a little makeup, a bottle of perfume. Murphy appeared beside me and stood with me, looking at the bathroom. She seemed a lot smaller than she usually does. "She called us," Murphy said. 911 has a call recorded. That's how we knew to come here. She called and said that she knew who had killed Jennifer Stanton and Tommy Tom, and now they were coming for her. Then she started screaming. That's when the spell hit her. The phone probably went dead right after. Murphy frowned up at me and nodded. "Yeah, it did. But it was working fine when we got here. Magic disrupts technology sometimes, you know that." I rubbed one eye. "Have you talked to any relatives, anything like that?" Murphy shook her head. "There aren't any relatives in town. We're looking now, but it might take some time. We tried to reach her boss, but he wasn't available. Mr. Beckett?" She studied my face, waiting for me to say something. "You ever heard of him?" she asked after a moment. I didn't look back at Murphy. I shrugged. Murphy's jaw tensed, little motions at the corners of her face. Then she said, "Greg and Helen Beckett. 3 years ago, their daughter Amanda was killed in a crossfire. Johnny Marconi's thugs were shooting it out with some of the Jamaican gang that was trying to muscle in on the territory back then. One of them shot the little girl. She lived for 3 weeks in intensive care and died when they took her off life support." I didn't say anything, but I thought of Mrs. Beckett's numb face and dead eyes. "The Beckett's attempted to lodge a wrongful death suit against Johnny Marconi, but Marconi's lawyers were too good. They got it thrown out before it even went to court. And they never found the man who shot the little girl. Word has it that Marconi offered to pay them blood money, make reparation, but they turned it down." I didn't say anything. Behind us, they were putting Linda in a body bag, sealing her in. I heard men count to three and lift her, put her into a gurney of some kind and wheel her out. One of the forensics guys told Murphy they were going to take a break and would be back in 10 minutes. She nodded and sent them out. The room got even more quiet. "Well, Harry," she said. Her voice was hushed, like she didn't want to disturb the apartment's new stillness. "What can you tell me?" There was a subtle weight to the question. She might as well have asked me what I wasn't telling her. That's what she meant. She took her hand out of her jacket pocket and handed me a plastic bag. I took it. Inside was my business card, the one I'd given to Linda. It was still curled a little where I'd palmed it. It was also speckled with what I presumed was Linda's blood. I looked at the part of the bag where you write the case number and the identification of the piece of evidence. It was blank. It wasn't on the records. It wasn't official. Yet. Murphy was waiting for my answer. She wanted me to tell her something. I just wasn't sure if she was waiting for me to tell her that a lot of people have my card, that I didn't know how it had gotten there, or if she wanted me to say how I had known the victim, how I had been involved with her. Then she would have had to ask questions, the kind of questions you ask suspects. "If I tell you," I said, "that I was having a psychic premonition, would you take me seriously?" "What kind of premonition?" she said. She didn't look up at me. "I sense," I paused, thinking of my words. I wanted them to be very clear. "I sense that this woman will have a police record, probably for possession of narcotics and solicitation. I sense that she used to work for the Velvet Room for Madame Bianca. I sense that she used to be close friends and lovers with Jennifer Stanton. I sense that if she had been approached yesterday and asked about those deaths, she would have claimed to know nothing." Murphy mulled over my words for a moment. "You know, Dresden," she said, her voice was tight, cool, furious, "if you had sensed these things yesterday, or maybe even this morning, it's possible that we could have talked to her. It's possible that we could have found out something from her. It's even possible." And she turned to me and slammed me against the doorway with one forearm and the weight of her body, suddenly and shockingly hard. "It's even possible," she snarled, "that she'd be alive." She stared up at my face. And she didn't look at all like a cutesy cheerleader now. She looked like a mother wolf standing over a body of one of her cubs and getting ready to make someone pay for it. This time, I was the one to look away. "A lot of people have my card," I said. "I put them all over. I don't know how she got it." "God damn it, Dresden," she said. She stepped back from me and walked away toward the blood-stained sheets. "You are holding out on me. I know you are. I can get a warrant for your arrest. I can have you brought in for questioning." She turned back to me. "Someone's killed 3 people already. It's my job to stop them. It's what I do." I didn't say anything. I could smell the soap and shampoo from Linda Randall's bath. "Don't make me choose, Harry." Her voice softened, if not her eyes or her face. "Please." I thought about it. I could bring everything to her. It's what she was asking. Not half the story, not part of the information. She wanted it all. She wanted all the pieces in front of her so she could puzzle them together and bring in the bad guys. She didn't want to work the puzzle knowing that I was keeping some of the pieces in my pocket. What could it hurt? Linda Randall had called me earlier that evening. She had planned on coming to me, to talk to me. She was going to give me some information, and someone had shut her up before she could. I saw 2 problems with telling Murphy that. 1, she would start thinking like a cop. It wouldn't be hard to find out that Linda wasn't exactly a high-fidelity piece of equipment, that she had numerous lovers on both sides of the fence. What if she and I were closer than I was admitting? What if I'd used magic to kill her lovers in a fit of jealous rage and then waited for another storm to kill her, too? It sounded plausible, workable, a crime of passion. Murphy had to know that the DA would have a hell of a time proving magic as a murder weapon. But if it had been a gun instead, it would have flown. The second problem, the one that worried me a lot more, was that there were already 3 people dead. If I hadn't gotten lucky and creative, there would have been 2 more dead people back at my apartment. I still didn't know who the bad guy was. Telling Murphy what little more I knew wouldn't give her any helpful information. It would only make her ask more questions, and she wanted answers. If the voice in the shadows knew that Murphy was heading the investigation to find him and was on the right track, he would have no qualms about killing her, too. There was nothing she could do to protect herself against it. She may have been formidable to your average criminal, but not all the Aikido in the world could do her any good against a demon. Then, too, there was the White Council. Men like Morgan and his superiors, secure in their own power, arrogant and considering themselves above authority of any laws but their own, wouldn't hesitate to remove one police lieutenant who had discovered the secret world of the White Council. I looked at the bloodstained sheets and thought of Linda's